Blog Talk Radio.
Well, aloha, ladies and gentlemen. I am Kelly Wells, the host of PWT Talks NXT. This is the show for November 18th, 2020. We are now moving in earnest toward War Games. We, as recently as last week, couldn't be 100% sure it was happening. I thought that they were definitely working towards that, but who knew what was going to happen. But yes, we are working toward War Games with another frenetic, but a little bit cleaner show, I would say. I dug this one, so I'm interested to hear whether you all did the same. You can find me all over social media at Spooky Milk or Spooky Milk Games. If you want to email our show, that is pwtorchnxt@gmail.com, or call us 515-605-9345 and hit 1 if you want to be on the show and ask us a question. So let me ask my other guy what he thought of today as we go into the main event. The main event, you know, I could go to the main event segment, the Finn Balor segment, but I have to give this women's match its due, the championship match, Rhea Ripley versus Io Shirai. This match went 22:03, which is a long TV match anyway, but especially long considering five of the other six matches tonight were between 4 and 5 minutes long. So this one really seemed like a marathon, an epic marathon. In the face of all those matches, Io Shirai cleanly defends her championship versus Rhea Ripley in a match that saw a little bit of blood, a couple of heat segments for each person because they were both faces, and a hug afterwards that certainly seemed like a goodbye and good luck. We've been saying this could be it for Rhea if she loses this match, as we thought she might, and she could be going to the main roster. We also got a segment earlier in the show of a lot of on-screen or behind-the-scenes talent talking about who they thought was going to win. This is real simple stuff, but definitely lends weight to a match like this. Main event, Io over Rhea Ripley. Tom Staupe, who are you?
Yes, I am at Tom Staupe on Twitter, and I felt this was far, far from a perfect show, but it had the best stuff on it that NXT has given us in some time. This, of course, being the best among anything. Like you said, they did a fine job of building it up, not just throughout the show, but over the past couple weeks. And as you and I discussed earlier, when we were going into our VIP podcast recording for NXT 8 years back that drops on Saturdays, we were considering this a 50-50. Like, I've said multiple times that what I wanted is exactly what ended up happening. Io to go over definitively and for there to be a handshake post-match. Yes, it felt a bit like a farewell. That is what we got, but this felt big because it feels like what Rhea has been working backward ever since WrestleMania. They've woven that nicely. And it felt like Rhea had a very, very strong chance to win, and it would have shaken up the challenger scene a bit as far as who it would have been realistic to position against the champion moving forward. So there's that. And then, of course, they just lived up to it in such a big way. Rhea in particular, I feel, has great chemistry with a lot of people. Bianca Belair, Charlotte Flair, like you can throw her in the ring with just about anybody and she gives you magic. And I feel like Io is on the short list of people that you can throw those two together at short notice. And they've been thrown together on short notice before and they give you magic. And this was the best match that we've seen from the two of them. Maybe even by a long shot, which is saying a lot because they've put together some good stuff before. So this was very, very good. And I would say defined by the fact that Rhea sold her butt off the whole time and she stayed in character while selling. I feel like a lot of times you see, well, first of all, selling in 2020 on NXT, imagine that. Second of all, selling and not breaking character to do it, not just dropping your facade to act like you're a limp fish on the floor. She really I was just so impressed with Rhea's character work throughout this and selling the damage that Io was doing to her. Both women got over very, very well over the course of this match, I felt. So that just leads me to the aggravation being indeed that they couldn't find a way, for whatever reason, they didn't want to find a way to announce or have the Undisputed Era return last week, or find a way to do it in the middle of the show and you know, make sure that they got separated effectively so we're not worrying about them brawling backstage the rest of the time. They did do the picture-in-picture of where's Finn, and then, oh, we're going back to picture-in-picture again to see Finn's arrival. So that is the aggravation, that there were times where this felt like it was a backdrop rather than the main event that it really should have purely been. But Io and Rhea rose above that and still lived up to their rightful main event slotting. Even if I do wish we didn't get, you know, sexist McAfee jokes afterward. And what was I? Actually, I wrote it down. The prince. Oh, looks like a princess. And then from Vic Joseph, we have EO leaving as Finn is coming in, and he says, "Well, there goes the women's champion, and here comes the champion." I'm just like, "All right, shut the hell up."
Yeah, Vic is not good. But yeah, Finn actually was the one person who did put over this match, because
True.
He came in and he actually made a point to put it over, and everything I know about Finn suggests that he probably felt weird about taking the shine off of this match that that rightfully had it. I don't think there was a really obvious decision here. I think laying this out had to be very difficult, because you want your returning championship after months of uncertainty, or maybe, you know, 6 weeks. It seems like a lifetime of uncertainty to be in the main event slot, but then you end up having it on this show where Rhea Ripley has to say her goodbye, we think. And it just seems like there was no really obvious way to do it. But the other thing about it was that because we had already seen the McAfee crew show up and they didn't have a beef with Finn, you kind of knew exactly what was going to happen after this match ended. So it just felt very perfunctory. It was fine because now we know there's war games, but it was just, I don't know. After a match that was so 50-50, it was funny to see a segment that we all saw coming a mile away. Kevin Catani, one of our frequent emailers, emailed us this. Salutations, gents. I hope this email finds you all well. The first question on everybody's mind is for Tom. Do we have any new entries on the Boogs list? In all seriousness, I thought tonight was a good show. Lots of fun, great action, and the return of UE. Following the conclusion of the women's title match, it looks like Rhea is not long for the NXT universe. That said, do you think she'll be a mystery entrant for the SmackDown Survivor Series team? Secondly, how long does the Leon Ruff storyline go for? Also, I know I've said this before, but tonight was definitely a Kelly appreciation episode, as all your faves showed up tonight, and no dream. Thanks, as always. Stay safe. Office hours are now over. The Professor, Kevin P. Catani, PhD. This was a good Kelly episode. All of them showed up. I got my Kai Kushida Grimes fix, and you know, I like a lot of these talents. And if you ask me, on any given day, maybe some of that could shift, but they are kind of my anchors, so it was good to see them. We will talk plenty about Leon Ruff. Also, I should mention, Nate is not with us this week. He's probably lurking in the background, but he has Never. Not seen the show. But he has not seen the show yet. I knew that I could probably draw him out with that. But he hasn't seen the show yet, so we won't be calling on him because he's not seen it. He will find out pretty much everything that happened by listening to us, but that's the next best thing to actually watching it, right?
Well, we can't do it spoiler-free.
I've never attempted that. That would be a challenge. That I don't think we are up to. So, let's go to the phone lines. Let's do that, because there are other things to talk about. As Tom said, far from a perfect episode. But what's funny is you end up, if the back end of shows when they're this frenetic are good, you do kind of forget some of the messes that happened beforehand. And there were some, I don't know if there were that many messes. There was at least one mess, but we'll get to that. But it's very much that Crash TV idea that when you throw that many things at the wall and the last one stick, then it might not matter that you also had to sit through Big Boss Man and Al Snow in the Kennel from Hell. So let's go to our friend Darrell from Georgia. Darrell, how are you doing today?
How are you guys doing tonight?
How's it going, man?
Doing all right.
Okay. Yeah, it was a crash, especially all the way to the end. I thought we was going to hear from the champ, but it seems like they was able to play it again so we could only see the champ but don't have to hear an update, and they give us something that take our mind off the update. My first question for tonight would be for you guys, knowing since we're getting this, that looks like it's going to be the main event, this 4-on-4 War Games match, does that mean that we're going to have the two championship matches, the two champions not have a match on War Games? And how would you guys feel about that? And what do you guys think about them not giving us a true update and crashing us with a couple of fights outside, especially that Kyle O'Reilly and Pete Dunne fight that they showed sporadically through there? How did you guys like that and think about all of that?
So it's weird not having a very clear picture of what's going on with the two top championships, but for War Games, those rules don't necessarily apply. The whole company at this time of year, it's all of a sudden the championships hardly matter. And you have champion versus champion matches in Survivor Series that have no real heat behind them, and they have to really try to give them something to spice them up. So what's the difference if NXT is doing the same thing? So I'm fine with the championships for this particular show playing second fiddle, especially when you've got such a long-form story being told with the men's War Games match. With Finn, I mean, a lot of it is just it might still be up in the air. It could be that they know what they're going to do already, but it could be that this was buying time, and that's why they had to pack it in with the men's War Games segment. With the women, it's not as clean, but it's fairly obvious who should be in it, and I thought that they kind of got away with it tonight, even though it was just real basic stuff with the heel women trying to bring the face women into it. Now, if we break down who we think's in it for the women, it still does leave one spot open for the women, for the babyface women, which could be Io Shirai if she decides to be. She was kind of tweening, but she's more or less a face at this point. So she could wedge into that, and Finn could have his match. Otherwise, I think we'll get Ciampa versus Thatcher if they feel like dragging that out. Thatcher's more or less a gatekeeper, but he's a gatekeeper who always has awesome matches, so I'm fine with that being on TakeOver. Tom, what did you take from this?
Yeah, I was thinking about these same things, and I went into the women's main event fully expecting that whoever won would end up as the fourth member of the women's babyface team, so I absolutely expect that to be Io. You could still do Rhea and keep her around and have her and Raquel have like one final chapter inside the cage there. But I mean, again, then you're leaving the champion off of the show. You could, you know, have her comment on the match or whatever, because all of her contenders are in that match, but it makes more sense to have her in there and get her big moonsault spot in, I'm sure. With Finn, it's a little more delicate, just because it seems like because they designed his announcement to not be an announcement, just be an appearance, that leads me to believe that they indeed just felt obligated to get him on screen as soon as he was presentable, or whatever bruising he may have is hidden under his beard or whatever it may be. But it seems like he is going to remain inactive for some time. But they've done, for my issues with this final segment of the night, they did do a nice job of making Finn peripheral to this issue between McAfee's crew and the Undisputed Era. I was pleasantly surprised that this did not go to the what I fully expected to be the typical William Regal announcement, where he comes out, looks exasperated, and just says "War Games," especially because they had given away, they had burned the reveal that War Games is indeed coming up earlier in the show with that Shotzi package. So I'm glad they didn't do that. It's already obvious enough. And this is one where you could have Finn out there on guest commentary, and we understand why he's not in action defending the title on the pay-per-view, but he's still got the title around his shoulder. And McAfee's group goes over and leads to a McAfee challenging for the NXT title. I think that is the direction I would look for here.
Yeah, I would not be surprised to see McAfee be the next champion either way. And those are words in that order that I did not think I would say a handful
of
months ago.
I was going to ask you if you misspoke, actually.
I can see that happening, and I don't have to squint very hard.
Their focus is on competition on Wednesday nights now, so.
Yep. It's a brave new world out there, gang, and Tank Abbott could be your next WCW champion. Darrell, what else do you have from tonight?
Oh, that is what I was thinking. I was thinking that they would at least how they build in Kushida and with this match from earlier and they announcing that he's continuing his winning streak, that was something that they was also building for a potential match, and they just had Finn come out there as a conduit to be able to bring back the Undisputed Era. They did the lights out gimmick and everything like that also. So that was my thought, and I'm hoping to find who will be the fourth woman. I thought that you could also bring somebody who we now don't know about, because, you know, they haven't stopped seeing using her as the announcement through the past two big events they have with now War Games and Halloween Havoc. So I guess that's her new role. But my second question for you guys would be, even though we don't have those top two titles, they are giving us an interesting story with the North American Championship. And it could be a good time to elevate that title even more, even though you got a guy who, say, people's trying to take him as a joke with what they're doing. He done talked himself into a triple threat match. How do you guys like that? And how do you like the overall story that they're telling with Leon Ruff? Because even if he do somehow get up out of this, I feel like that could still lead to another way that you can get that title on to Pat McAfee's crew, since we all putting all the titles in that crew right now.
So I dig this a lot. I really like the way that this story is panning out, and Leon's holding up his end of it on the mic as a character, and they got to, so when wrestling is at its worst, there are no consequences for the actions of characters. When it's at its best, they tell stories where people react in a realistic way. And Damian Priest, yes, he made Leon Ruff a champion through what he's done to basically troll Johnny Gargano. But Leon Ruff was rightfully pissed off, because he's a man and he's got his own pride. And I can't believe they're already getting a fairly interesting title reign out of this. So in the opening match, we have Leon Ruff against Johnny Gargano. Same opener as last week. This time the champion is Leon Ruff. This went 4:48. Johnny Gargano wins by disqualification when Priest yanks Leon Ruff out of the ring to stop him from getting pinned, and then gives him a forearm. So Ruff wins by disqualification. this was, and of course, then they go backstage. Priest is talking to William Regal, and Leon Ruff shows up, and he's not appreciative, like Priest foolishly thinks he will be, and he smacks Priest, and he walks off, and Regal, to his credit, says, you know, you had that coming. I dug this. They're going to get a triple threat out of this, which we probably all called before we even saw that segment. Those of us who are longtime fans of wrestling knew that it was probably going to head that way. But then later on, when Priest was going to have a match, he was introduced for a match that was never intended to happen. Gargano stops that by attacking him, and Leon Ruff ends up kind of laying them both out, partially by accident, because Priest is essentially collateral damage, but he gets away and he's in control. This also had, for me, a hilarious visual, basically from the point of view of Ruff, as the two guys are like looking like surprised, like lost puppies outside the ring, looking in and being like, this is our champion. And they're just kind of like stunned looking in at Leon Ruff. I dug this. I am, as stated, the world's biggest Leon Ruff fan. So I dug this. I know that Tom was way more cautious about this. And this by far is the angle that I'm waiting to hear about most from Tom. So Tom, take it away.
Yeah, here we go. Last week I got accused of liking Leon Ruff. No, I'm sure he's very likable. I do not have a history of watching him. I only know him from his jobs in NXT, which only started very recently. This is not a Drake Maverick story where he gets fired and claws his way back. This isn't even what I think is a better parallel. Sean Maluda, who showed up as an unsigned jobber for years and years. If Sean Maluda was getting this, I think I would be much more behind it. Like, oh my gosh, they finally did something with this kid. But Leon Ruff, they have not told this story. And they tried, you know, after shotgunning it last week, they tried to scramble to tell the story that they failed to tell before tonight. But it's too little too late. This is typical NXT. They have a good thing. Even when NXT is at its best and they're telling long form stories, they still, throughout the card, or up and down the card, they come up with these good ideas, and then they just burn them immediately. If they had kept Leon Ruff just doing jobs for a while, but looking okay and making us hopeful, then I think this would be much more effective. What I'm dancing around here is, and I'm not a size guy, so I don't even like hearing myself say this, but this guy's just a hair above Marco Stunt, where I feel uncomfortable watching him in the ring. And even against somebody who is shorter than he is, Johnny Gargano, of course, Johnny Gargano being someone who does not, his size does not hold him back, and he's got plenty of muscle on him. He looks like a wrestler, unlike, the toothpick Leon Ruff. Johnny Gargano also excels at getting great matches out of anybody. And yet here we are looking at Leon Ruff having a lot of offense on Johnny Gargano, and I cannot believe any of it. I thought that the later on in the night, the popping up of the heads, the simultaneous popping up of the heads of Gargano and Priest was way too cartoony and staged. And that's how I felt about the Gargano Ruff match too. It just, I did not believe a single thing. Knowing Johnny Gargano as a wrestler over years of NXT TV, I did not believe a single thing that Ruff was doing to him would have been effective. And it seems like the idea was like, oh, hey, you know, this Damian Priest guy reminds us of Razor Ramon. Oh my gosh, you know what we should do? We should do a 1-2-3 kid thing. Yeah. But this is not 1-2-3 kid, because the storyline is not the little engine that could. Sure, why not? It's not the little engine that could. It's it's the fact that Leon Ruff can't get it done. He shouldn't be getting it done, and the only reason he is because of the distractions of Priest. So, yes, if I'm mining for good things here, the best part is that then Ruff makes the hard turn against the cartoonishness and tries to get real serious and be like, you know, he now he's wearing all black. Like, you usually had criticized, like, oh, you're wearing all black now. But it, instead of just, like,
signaling, everyone wore all black tonight. The last segment with eight guys all in black was a little hard to follow.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. You particularly notice it with him, though, since he's had the wardrobe change. And he's saying, like, you know, you consider me a joke. Well, it was a little weird that maybe it was an acting thing. Obviously, I get what he was going for, but saying like, "Oh, maybe I should just relinquish the title right here," it sounded a little bit more defeated than adamant. But of course, you know, William Regal looking at Priest and saying, "Well, serves you right." You know, that was the stronger part of the storyline. And while I confess that I was worried they were just moving away from Johnny and moving into Priest versus Ruff. Where, you know, I already said what I said about Ruff versus Gargano. So then I'm wondering, well, somebody who actually is tall, like Priest, like how is that going to look? Because I was of the mindset, like, they're just going to go full 1-2-3 kid with this. And I'm not buying it. So putting it as a triple threat gives them the out, obviously. You know, Ruff can sneak away a win in that and hold on to the belt. And then, I was going to say it could go to either Grimes or Thatcher next, but with Thatcher now tied up with Ciampa, I'm just saying Grimes.
What I've wanted for so long, and when I felt that they had mined everything they could out of babyface Rey Mysterio, I wanted him to win a championship and then get into his own head about his greatness, surround himself like flank himself with two giant guys and that they were his muscle and he won all his matches because of them. Everything became about that. And that he was his own biggest fan. And that would be really interesting to me if Leon Ruff went this way. I'm kind of fantasy booking long-term here, which is ridiculous because we're talking about a storyline that just got off the ground. But that's something I've always wanted to see. I guess the fact that Ruff started jobbing on NXT TV like a year and a half ago makes me say it's plenty long for this story kind of to work, and then regularly-ish for the last 6-7 months is
Was
enough.
Was it that long ago?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah,
maybe
I actually
maybe
looked
he just doesn't stick. All right.
We're old, so... So time passes differently for us than it used to.
I mean, that changes the angle I'm coming at this with a bit. If I'm simply, you know, incorrect about that, I mean, I'll admit that I only really remember him over the past couple months. Maybe he just didn't stick out in my mind. I mean, another example I would use is if he wasn't tied up with Legado del Fantasma now, if he hadn't gotten, you know, that calling. Then I would have said Raul Mendoza would have been another one, even though, you know, I mean, Sean Maluda is an even better example because even on house shows, he was the jobber. Raul Mendoza was always a token babyface crowd pop for house shows and dark matches. But yeah, I guess Ruff hasn't stuck out in my mind.
I'm not going to get on your case for forgetting the first Leon Ruff match because it was a Forgotten Son squash.
Oh.
So like,
oh gosh, I do remember that now. Oh,
yeah.
No, I do remember that.
And his partner, Adrian Alanis, who I'm not sure if he became anything. I did have to look that part of it up.
Yeah.
Sure.
I remember Jackson Riker powerbombing him.
Yeah, that was a thing. When the Forgotten Sons are they doing anything? I don't care if they're doing anything. They sure aren't.
That's actually related to that Boogs List question that Catani asked us about.
Oh, gosh, yeah, I only know a little about that. I'm just back on the main roster train, folks, for like 4 weeks now, which for me is an insane number of weeks in a row, but that's where I am. Before we get off the train further, let's go back to Darrell and see what else he's got for us.
Yeah, and that match happened December the 4th, 2019, when he made that appearance with Adrian Alanis in a losing effort against the Forgotten Son, Steve Cutler and Wesley Blake.
So okay, so not quite
a year.
Oh, you know what? I looked it up and I thought that I was seeing April 12th. I was seeing December 4th because me being the stupid American I am, I've got the month first, but that's not how they have it on this website. So it was December 4th. Okay.
Yeah. And at least he's not the story they're not telling is similar to like an Ellsworth story that WWE told the main roster told a while ago back when he thought he started getting overconfident in himself when it was John Moxley that was helping him get wins and stuff like that, and they tried to hurry up and quick shift it to make him feel serious, and then they did the interview in the back to, you know, like, well, should I give up the title? And then he came out afterwards after slapping him. And I guess that was his way of talking tough and being tough by coming out there and trying to get the best of both guys and kind of walking off of William Regal. So that's what kind of made me be like, let me give this story a chance. And they got a couple of weeks to tell more of it and see where it goes. Now, my next question for you guys would be this. We seen Tommaso Ciampa come out there and stand up for somebody. They, again, going back to putting him back as a face. They did that one little brief heel run for him because, you know, he should have been the face anyway, but somebody got hurt who probably be coming back pretty soon. I won't speak on him until when he comes back. But how do you guys like that he's going to take on Thatch Cam and his wrestling style? And I like the interest that the update interest that they did to him and his Thatcher too. How do you guys like this? And what do you guys see this going after this? And where should Ciampa go after this?
Ciampa seems to live in this kind of weird state where he's kind of floating, and he just floats from place to place. And what he's doing doesn't necessarily matter. And winning these feuds isn't a huge deal, but losing these feuds doesn't hurt him. It's not necessarily a criticism exactly. It's just like, I feel like he slots in when they put him in where they know somebody else needs a match, and then he wins it. It's very odd for me, the spot he's in. And I feel like Kushida is kind of in the same spot where he seems but he just beats guys that they want to give TV time, and then he doesn't seem to be moving up the card. That said, Tommaso Ciampa and Timothy Thatcher, there shouldn't be a damn thing wrong with it. It should be interesting. So Timothy Thatcher took on August Gray, his former student who broke away, and Gray had gear that, okay, in my recap, I explained his gear as a mix between early 90s Skybox basketball cards and the background screen when Toe Jam and Earl are going from one level to the next. That's what I got. That is specifically the two things that I got from his gear. I like it. It sets him apart. It's just really weird to see somebody not my age doing something like that. Thatcher goes over in 426. A lot of the matches, four of these matches, where we're in the 420 range. Thatcher goes over. Tommaso Ciampa comes out and just kind of stares him down. Thatcher says, I don't have a problem with you. And he backs up. And afterwards, Ciampa says, I want to fight you. This is interesting to me because Tommaso Ciampa is essentially doing a get off my lawn gimmick and saying these young guys, blah, blah, blah. And then he goes after Thatcher, who's not young and also is doing a get off my lawn gimmick. It's so strange to me that that's the person he'd go after. But if he's a babyface and you want him to take on a guy who's essentially a gatekeeper, I guess, you know, it's going to be a good match with Thatcher. So, Tom, anything more to unpack there?
Saved by the Bell opening credits sequence is what I'll say for Gray's gear. And
oh yeah, that works too. Yeah,
I'm gonna have to try to force August into my mind because Vic Joseph misspoke however many weeks ago and called him Austin, and then that's the name that got stuck up there. So I'm still thinking of him as Austin Gray, even though I know that's incorrect. I even joked about it last week, saying that he sounded like a Twilight character, and I meant August went on to keep on calling him Austin. But this segues nicely from talking about Leon Ruff, because I see this guy not wearing a T-shirt for the first time, and I'm like, he's a toothpick too. Like, if you, I don't want to make this my new gimmick that I don't like, you know, super skinny guys. I don't think I'm a size guy, but at a certain point, you got to go like, well, it is wrestling. Maybe you should have an ounce of muscle on your body. So I'm okay with if they, if they saw something in him and they signed him to want to develop him. But he's on TV already regularly. At this point, I don't really see an opening for him to come back right away. So maybe he does go off and get developed for a while. And this was just like, they just needed somebody to fill this spot for a little bit. And it was him. Cause he had the Evolve experience. I don't know. But I had the same takeaways. Yeah. I think I just had the same takeaways as you, that I am slightly disappointed that this seems to be Thatcher's ceiling, but I still get excited for his matches because they're excellent. Unlike the Leon Ruff thing, August Gray barely got any offense in at all. He got like one heel kick that I noticed, just enough for a hope spot, but Thatcher crushed him as he should have. So this is what it should have been. And even if Thatcher is at what appears to be his ceiling, I'm not going to argue with getting Thatcher versus Ciampa, whether it's 3 minutes or 3 months.
And these NXT gatekeepers, especially in these days where they're getting more and more of the guys on the roster because they're shortening matches, we should be getting Thatcher every week. And it certainly seems like we're getting him every week. So if being at this spot means we get him every week, then I can live with that. Durrell, anything else?
Last thing for you guys, we got to see Cameron Grimes. I thought this was gonna be a blindfold match, not a bag match, but hey, they continue with the company spot with Cameron Grimes. I like him as a character, and I feel like once you have him where you want it with it, and you can start making him serious by giving him a title run, and I know Tom said maybe the title could get on him. Again, he will be my second choice if they don't put it on a Pete Dunne, and I could get a Pete Dunne versus Kyle O'Reilly for the title, for the North American Championship rivalry feud. But if we can get Cameron Grimes being serious and start working his way up to be a serious champion, even just a second-level champion, I would. But how did you guys like this match and this whole fiasco of whatever they called it, and what you guys thought about it?
Durrell, thanks as always. I think the word fiasco was well chosen. So Dexter Lumis and Cameron Grimes in a blindfold match. And as you said, yes, a bag match. These were quite the blindfolds. This went 4:25 is where I clocked it, but it's kind of hard to say because there was no bell. This did not end. Daryl Sharma was the referee for this. He was the zombie referee, which, you know, I like that they chose him to be the referee, but didn't feel the need to talk about him being the zombie referee anymore because it's stupid. So
you must have just been taking notes when they did, because they definitely did.
Oh, they did? I guess that I was. Okay. Oh, well. Well, that's stupid. But what are you going to do? So,
lucky you.
It is so funny to me to see a feud completely carried by the guy that's losing every match and segment. And that's what we have here. I won't say I don't get it. I get why the character of Lumis is beating the character of Grimes, but the character of Grimes has a high ceiling and is losing all these matches, and the character of Lumis is 100% at his ceiling or above it and is winning. And I don't know what the end game is for Lumis, because you can't take this character and really easily plug him into a championship. If he's in a feud, it has to be a fight that's picked with him, not by him, because he doesn't pick fights. I just don't see how he gets to be in a spot that's any higher on the card than he is now, even though he's winning these matches. And then you've got Grimes, who is your classic Miz character, Four Horsemen character, whatever you want to say, loses a ton of matches, but it doesn't matter because he gets himself back over. And his ceiling is relatively high. I would have thought that he'd be in the North American Championship picture by now, but that is a really crowded group of guys that could be part of that. So, Tom, I know what you thought about this, but tell me anyway.
Yeah, it was a troll job on those of us who feel that all Dexter Lumis does is stand there, as I have said over and over again. He literally just stood there. Like, I've said that as an exaggeration, and now that is literally what he did. He just stood there. I mean, Grimes is just delicious. Again, waiting for the bag to go over Dexter Lumis's head, and then looking so happy with himself when he tries to go in for the sneak attack. And then after agreeing to a blindfold match, getting stopped by the referee and saying, "But if I put this on, I can't see." It's just perfect. as far as the blindfolds versus the bags, I believe that's just, you know, we talked about the history of blindfold matches last week, and we
called.
What's that?
I said you called.
Oh yeah. You were the one who was able to dig up for us that there were more than we remembered happening. But, you know, at least on, you know, in WWF's history, the bags, to my understanding, I'm trying to dull this so I don't sound like a know-it-all, but the bags are easier to see through. The word is not gimmicked. They're not gimmicked. It's just like once you have the burlap sack on your head and it's close to your face, you can see through it, but the camera cannot see through it to your face. So it looks like you have an opaque, you know, covering in front of your face. The blindfolds are harder too, and then the word would be gimmick. So that's my terrible explanation of why it's bags and not blindfolds. But okay, so Dexter Lumis just standing there. Dexter was working as well as they seem to think it's working, and I say they seem to think it's working because they keep putting him on TV. If the character was working like a Kane, just imagine Kane there, and then Kane just standing there while the Miz character flails around, works, because the comedy, the effective comedy, I was genuinely laughing, even though I thought it was incredibly stupid. I was laughing at Cameron Grimes. They got that desired effect, but that comedy would have a sense of dread hanging over it when you're just waiting for Kane or Dexter Lumis to start doing the job himself, start doing the damage himself rather than letting the comedy heel do the damage to themselves. So the framing of it should have worked, but it did not work because Dexter Lumis has not been an effective character. It is not performed effectively by Sam Shaw. And then this is just a detail at the end of the segment that doesn't pertain to anything else I was saying, but this was just such a mess that I've got to mention it. Then Cameron Grimes actually very impressively escapes over the he gets tossed into the chain link and then just scoots himself over like it's a video game glitch, and he just clipped through the plexiglass. It was quite impressive. Then he runs off to the glass, and they've pre-planned a shot where the camera goes up to the opposite side of the glass to give him an extreme close-up. So while he is peering through the chain link and plexiglass, after having plainly seen which direction Grimes ran off in, he's looking around for Grimes through the plexiglass, which in the context of this shot has a giant camera right in front of it, so he wouldn't be able to see anything anyway. Incredibly stupid.
Yeah. And, you know, when Grimes escaped, I even wrote it in my recap when I was like, well, it's done for now, thinking they'll come back to this later in the show, very much in the same way that they did with the House of Terrors. But that's not what happened. we got what we got, and they didn't go back to it. Is this feud over? Who can say?
Probably not since Grimes ran away. And yeah. There was so much stupidity. I forgot to mention the same thing that Darrell already mentioned, that, yeah, once we got to the point where Dexter did have the sack taken off of his head, he hadn't even done anything yet. So it's just like, oh, okay, so this wasn't really a blindfold match. All right, okay.
Yeah, a blindfold match with not a lot of blindfolding, but we did have a massive ref bump, so, you know. Wrestling. Okay, so mid-show main event was a women's tag match. The women got lots and lots of minutes in this show. 10 women wrestled on this show. That is, I don't know if that's a record for NXT TV, but it's got to be close. Two women's tag matches and one women's singles match. The women, a lot of minutes here. Ember Moon and Toni Storm versus Dakota Kai and Raquel Gonzalez. They did talk with Moon and Storm a little bit beforehand. It got mildly tense as they were both talking about their intentions for the championship. But that was kind of pushed to the background as we see that this is more just to promote War Games. So Ember and Toni go over Dakota Kai and Raquel Gonzalez in a very spirited 12 minutes and 7 seconds, lots of action here. And I thought everybody did a pretty good job here. Toni ends up scoring the pin, which I was surprised by, because Ember's been kind of the person, but I guess they want to keep them both strong if they're both going to have their championship opportunities. And she rolled up Dakota Kai. This was in a match with a lot of impact. It was a finish that was a small package, but whatever. It was all just to set up the fact that Candice LeRae and Indy Hartwell come to the ring and they attack Ember and Toni after the match, obviously trying to recruit Dakota Kai and Raquel Gonzalez. Very interesting to me to see that Indy Hartwell already in this position where she is going to probably be in a War Games match. That's a hell of a sink or swim for her, because her last singles match on TV didn't go super well, even though she's done a lot of good stuff, as Tom has said, on the Coconut Loop. So that's where we went with that. We also have an email from C.F. Falvey. Good evening, gents. Longtime listener, but first time emailer to you guys. I have to say I wasn't the biggest fan of her in her first run, but since her return, something is really clicking for me about Ember Moon. The new presentation is good, and she just seems to be carrying herself more believably. She also seems to be covering a little more weight than before her injury, which really gives her look a unique toughness that wasn't there before. Given all that, do you think that her stay on NXT will be more of a short tune-up type stint before moving back to the main roster, or is she in NXT for the long haul? Given the obvious story of never being able to beat Asuka and the built-in story there, her new badass persona really could work, especially as Asuka has absolutely nothing to do on Raw. Thanks, Chris from Milwaukee. I think it's a good question about Ember. I would have said she was in this for the long haul, but then I started watching the main roster again and seeing just the sorry state of the women's division, especially on Raw, and just how it should be utilized. They have the talent, but they're not utilizing it in any meaningful way. And maybe Ember Moon strengthened could be a real boon to it. So that's a good question. So on the mid-show main event, Tom.
Yeah, like Chris, and thanks for the email, Chris. I have noticed for sure Ember's new look, and I think it's fantastic. You know, what do I want to say? Like body weight. He described it as she's carrying a little extra weight, which, I mean, sure. But I think she looks fantastic. It's a good look for her. She looks like a woman. And I don't know. Maybe
we're dancing around the same words. I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's strong. I'm all for it. Maybe the glitter around the eye is a bit much, but I think it's excellent. And this match, the main roster, regarding the question specifically, yeah, you know, it's sort of a new frontier here with people like Ember and Finn returning to NXT, and also with NXT seeming to want to hold on to potentially game-changing stars more than just being a funnel to send them up to the main roster. But I wouldn't discount it if it feels like, you know, she's plateauing in NXT at some point in the future, and there's a spot for her on the main roster. I think that they can just have some roster fluidity and move people back and forth at one point. So yeah, that's a long way of saying I don't know, but those are the reasons I don't know. I thought that this was a very strong match. I yet again had it in my notes to joke about, oh boy, my new favorite wrestler, Toni Storm, just like I did last week. And I thought Toni came off like a star tonight, in the backstage promo and out in the ring, you know, for her entrance and the whole shebang. I think that to credit is the fact that there was a lot going on in this match. You know, she was given two different people to work off of, and then, you know, the partner that she's really building the number one contendership story with in Ember. So she had a lot of meat on the bone to chew on, and she had the luxury of tagging out. So she didn't have to, you know, be in action the entire time. So that's for Toni. That's a very good. So this is it was an excellent night for Toni in my opinion, which hopefully is high praise coming from me, because I've always been, ever since the first time I saw her, I was sort of, I've just been very critical of Toni. So tonight was good. And as I scanned past my errant note that Moonstorm would be a cool name for a tag team, I'm not sure if I entirely agree with myself there, but I wrote it down.
You know what's weird? I thought that too, and then I was like, wait, is that good or is it just two words?
Yeah. it's Moonstorm. It's a Magic the Gathering enchantment card. But all right. So I really, really liked what they did in this match. If we didn't get the excellent main event match that we got, then this would have been the best thing on the card. They did even though Raquel had one or two awkward spots in there, they did a really nice job of making Toni and Ember look strong, like they do view themselves as the number one, the rightful number one contenders. And I agree with pairing them up in this way. If they weren't going to just shoot Toni up to brief contention like we suspected they would upon her return. And then I mentioned Raquel because, unfortunately, Dakota feels like the odd woman out again, where the focus on that team is Raquel just beating the crap out of Ember and Toni during these heat segments. And that had me thinking like, well, this might add an interesting extra layer to when Toni and Ember then wrestle one another for the contendership, maybe next week or something. They would have to go to that quickly so they could still be selling the effects of the beatdown from Raquel. Maybe they even try to involve Raquel in this number one contender issue. And my mind is going to all these interesting places as far as, you know, who's going to be next up for the women's champion. And then they just shoehorn the War Games thing in there because it's November and it's War Games, or, you know, it's going to be beginning of December. It's that time of year. So that's the part where, you know, it's like every was last year the first women's War Games?
It was. It was. Yeah, there's only been one, and big storyline and massive win for Rhea and Candace.
Yes, over Shayna. We gushed about that match like crazy, and it had been built beautifully. I think we went as far as to say on a number of occasions that it was one of the best told stories that NXT has probably ever done. And on the men's side, it seemed like they were just having an obligatory 4-on-4 because it was War Games time. So this year, that's flip-flopped. You know, the McAfee Undisputed Era storyline is not one of the best storylines NXT's ever done, but they've been working toward it for a while. And the women, it's just, you know, it's just thrown together. But at least it's representative of the women who have interesting storylines going on right now and who stand a good shot at being title contenders, you know, as soon as the War Games match ends.
There was 56 minutes and 41 seconds of wrestling on this show. And 38 minutes, 39 seconds of that belonged to the women. Just 18:02 for the men. This was a heavy women's episode as far as in-ring product. The other women's match was Casey Catanzaro and Caden Carter against Candice LeRae and Indy Hartwell. Candice goes over Caden in 4:29. This was simple to the point. Casey and Caden, they lose on TV. It's what they do. And Candice and Indy were just working toward the war games here. Shotzi, in the previous segment to this, Shotzi Blackheart was promoting you, when you get beat down, you just rebuild. And War Pigs was playing the Black Sabbath song. And she's rebuilding her tank, which I assume she will enter in war games, and perhaps this will be the kind of tank that the whole team could enter on. That's just me spitballing, and maybe that's what they got in planned for war games, and that'll be your big visual for the women's match. So that was a good segment, by the way. Shotzi, they've really found a way to use her strange cadence and her unconventional delivery to really work for her, much in the same way that they took Undertaker, a guy who could not act, and they found a way to use his cadence and fit it perfectly to a character. But that's kind of what they're doing. So Casey and Caden versus Candice and Indy. And since we're kind of talking about Survivor Series, I'm going to go to two emails about, one email about Survivor Series. It's JB from Detroit. If anyone from the current NXT roster gets involved in Survivor Series, who would you guess it to be? What would their be their role at the pay-per-view, and would it be a main roster call-up? As always, love the show, and go VIP. That person would be Rhea Ripley. I would have said that before tonight's match, and you know I would if you listen to the show. But I definitely think she'll be in the women's match, whether that means she's taking the place of somebody on Raw or she fulfills the spot still open on SmackDown. Tom, on the last women's tag match, and anybody who might show up on Survivor Series.
You are correct that the only answer is Rhea. I do not expect that to happen at the pay-per-view, though. I think that Rhea stepping up to challenge Asuka after the pay-per-view is the much more interesting direction than what is more probable in Charlotte returning to challenge Asuka. Either way, I believe that Rhea is going to end up on Raw because that is where Charlotte is, and that is where the meat is on the bone for her. But I would vouch for getting Rhea versus Asuka before Charlotte finally does come back. So we shall see. But yes, Rhea is the answer there. Man, they play Black Sabbath a lot at played at Full Sail Live during the commercial breaks. So I have started to associate those songs with NXT anyway. So this felt like a familiar association. And yeah, the video was very strong. It's possible. It's just visuals to promote, you know, something warlike for war games. But I do agree that it has me wondering, like, oh boy, what's Shotzi working on? And of course, it's going to be some kind of tank. Yeah, they've piqued my curiosity with that. And I very much enjoyed this match. This is the kind of match that I watch NXT for. Candice, as she does, is being the Natalya in the group, and bringing these three developmental projects along. Indy, Caden, and Casey are all at varying degrees of development, definitely TV ready for sure, although that was not the case for all of them as recently as a year ago. So I have very much enjoyed tracking the progress of all three of these wrestlers. So getting them all in there in a little tag match and having Candice in there with them, that's what I watch NXT for. So good stuff.
Okay, we had just one other match we haven't talked about, and then a few emails as well. That match is Kushida versus Arturo Huas. So previously in the segment before the commercial, we got Arturo Huas up next, and I was very excited about this. We're finally getting him on TV. He's finally going to get a push. And then he comes out, and Kushida's his opponent. Now, I'm a massive Kushida fan, but I was really hoping that this was somebody that Arturo Huas was going to plow through, and that he finally was getting some kind of push, some early push, some anything. But I guess that is still not in the cards for him, as he did the job to Kushida in 423. These guys could have a wonderful 12-20 minute match if the storyline called for it, but that's not where these guys are for now. Kushida wins, and he's continuing to win since he returned to TV. It still doesn't seem like he's really figured in, other than this guy's going to win and get a push, and we have no end game, Tom.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, even as his entrance was loading, you know, as the lights were going down and the graphics were hitting the screen and the music was playing, I was still like, wait, I think I recognize this. Who is this? It just, he so quickly leaves my mind. And like you, I spent the commercial break going, oh yeah, we're finally getting Arturo Huas. About a year ago, they started giving us video packages for him, a little bit less than a year ago, and it never went anywhere. He continued jobbing in dark matches at Full Sail Live. Then he popped up in Raw Underground, and I think he only was on for one episode. And I just, this guy, I've gushed about him before. He's so talented. He comes off as legit because he is legit. And the best thing about him is how versatile he is. Not only, even if you know that, I'm jumbling around where I want to go with this. One of the most annoying things that NXT does right now is not give people entrances. So I spend the commercial break, hoping, excited to see Arturo Huas. And then we come right back and he's already in the ring. Like, okay, this is not going to go well. Kushida comes out. I'm like, okay, this is not going to go well for Arturo. But here's the part that I was getting at. He still comes off as enough of a, even though you know that he's going to lose, and even though they care so little about the match that they're going to picture in picture about where's Finn Balor during the course of the match, he still seems like he's a challenge for Kushida to overcome. And Kushida has proven something and had to go deeper in his chamber than he usually does to win even this short match. And that is exactly what I love seeing Huas bring out in the talent that he enhances. That's the exact reason why I always say that I like him. And it's that versatility. He can do this for any opponent. The one that I always bring up is when he did it for Dijakovic, which was a completely different kind of match, but he was still able to go back to his jiu-jitsu roots and try to find ways to bring the big man down, which of course with Dijakovic, well, it's been a while since I've seen the match. I don't remember whether it worked or not, but it certainly forced Dijakovic to find a way to win that's different from the way he usually finds. So I'm happy to see Huas back on TV. I'm happy to see what was an excellent little match between these two guys, but man, they got me excited for Arturo and then they didn't even give him an entrance.
I have my silver lining that I'm looking at is it kind of seemed like Kushida was trying to give him the endorsement afterwards and prove that, yeah, all right, you brought it. Like, it seemed like there was a little bit of that after the match, even though Huas himself was trying to stay in a heel context and not totally embrace that. It seemed like Kushida was kind of trying to give it. Maybe I'm looking for something here. But
That's true, and I noticed that as well, and Kushida did have to win with a leverage pin, so there is that. And the other detail to it is, and maybe this just speaks to like why they haven't actually gone with Huas, maybe there's a dot that hasn't quite been connected, but typically, once you lose, you roll out and you give the winner the ring, and you just aren't seen on camera anymore unless there's going to be an angle. But instead of just laying out until the cameras had cut, like they usually do, Huas walked in front of the hard cam, or in view, I should say, in view of the hard cam on the opposite side of the ring while Kushida was celebrating, and he was looking frustrated. It wasn't focal. It didn't look like we were supposed to have seen it. It looked like he was probably just supposed to lay out. But that happened, so that, you know, we at least saw a little bit of his emotion after the loss.
Our friend Bruce emailed us and said, "Crew, we had an Arturo Huas sighting. Tom and I rejoice." Tom and you, I love him too. What the hell? Now give me Huas against Timothy Thatcher. Sorry, Ciampa. And once again, if you haven't already, go watch Huas's match with Pete Dunne. I guess I can officially say I'm part of the Torch team now. A, go VIP, and remember, stay bar soap. Wait, wrong show. Come for the movie. Wait, that's the other NXT show. Come to hear Nate inevitably mute himself. That works, right? Bruce Lee, PhD from Seattle. He actually typed Seattle instead of Seattle, but he was very excited, and so I understand that he blew it. So yeah, he was very excited about our Arturo Huas, as evidenced by the many, many all caps in here. He won't do that though. He won't throw all caps at you when he does the Raw alt perspective reports, as our buddy Bruce is doing now. So thank you, Bruce from Seattle. We go to Regal. Regal went to Boa's. This was weird because, like, I don't know if we've ever seen a guy just go to the wrestler's dwelling. And it seems like he just lives in an apartment, a nondescript apartment. Boa does. Regal looking for Boa and saying, "You haven't been in the PC," which seems like a really funny, nondescript way to approach somebody who was like attacked by the New Year's dragon or whatever. What's happening? Boa said, "She's coming. She's coming. And I'm not going to the PC." Regal said, "Are you talking about Zaya? I don't know what you're talking about. Zaya hasn't been there in 2 weeks." And he says, "No, not Zaya. She's coming. She's coming." So I assume that the old man who showed up to give the letter to Boa last week was not a red herring exactly, but just kind of a one-time deliverer of a message. And whoever she is going to be a big deal. I don't know if we're supposed to think this is somebody we've seen or if this is just going to be some kind of mob boss. I want to be careful with this. Tom, what's going on here?
It's very weird. And unfortunately, you know, all I can say regarding what's going on is we're just going to have to wait and see. There wasn't really much to go on here. If you mentioned it, I missed it. Boa also had very bad makeup around his eyes that made it look like he hadn't been sleeping in a while.
I did. I was going to say, I was like, are they going for black eyes? Are they going for punch? I just imagine Regal knocking there because they planned it and then they didn't meet beforehand. And Regal gets there and he's like, "Oh, what the hell is this?"
Yeah, it looks like a...
just a really bad makeup job.
It looks like you just burnt a roast. But yeah, it was a strange way to frame it. Obviously, I don't know where Boa lives, but that's basically what a lot of the mid-tier apartment complexes around here look like. I don't think it's Baldwin Park, even though whatever. As I start naming places that Boa could possibly live on our podcast. I don't know where he lives, but yeah, I've seen plenty of other wrestlers posting from their actual apartments, and it looks like, those are the exteriors. So, yeah, that's definitely for you, this part of Orlando. Very weird segment that did not really give me much to go on as far as the direction of the story.
Our friend Jack Argyle emailed us, "Hey guys, hope you're all safe and well. Was wondering the past week about where NXT can strengthen talent-wise Women's division is perfectly stocked up, but I do feel they need two high-level tag teams. At least, I love the Dane and Maverick storyline, and they are a solid addition, but I feel like we need two solid, credible teams. Obviously, we thought Indus Cher and Grizzled Young Vets would be here right now. Hopefully, the Young Vets can be back once the borders open up. Do you guys know if Indus Cher will be coming back? I would also love AOP to be re-signed to NXT. Are there any other tag teams you think could thrive in NXT? I saw the Rascals contracts are expiring with Impact. Haven't seen a lot of them, but also think Angelico and Jack Evans have been criminally underutilized in AEW. Also, where would you all rank the Four Horsemen in order for best careers so far? Becky, for me, being the first top star female in WWE, has to be first. Not sure where I'd rank the other three. Think Charlotte has an incredible consistency to her matches, but does seem to flip heel and face too much. I think Sasha's one of the best performers today, male or female, and has huge star power. And Bayley has been outstanding the last year or so from a character perspective. How would you place them in order of best careers so far in the business? Cheers, guys. Stay safe. Jack A. from Swansea, Wales. What a lovely, difficult question it is trying to rank the horsewomen because they all have been successful. That is awesome. And not typical of a group in wrestling because someone's always Marty Jannetty, but nobody is. As far as the tag teams, I know Tom doesn't like AOP. I think they're fine for their kind of tag team that they are, but they are redundant if you get Indus Cher back because you've got your monster team already. And I don't know that a company with only four or five tag teams doesn't need two monster tag teams. That doesn't work. One is just fine. And I feel like on a 2-hour show once a week, that's plenty. There are certainly teams that have been underutilized on AEW because they got so many good teams. So somebody's going to be. I don't know if Angelico and Jack Evans are WWE style, but maybe they're NXT style. That wouldn't shock me. As far as the Vets coming back, I would love that. But I just don't know why they would want to with COVID being as it is, Tom.
The Force Women. Insert joke about Sasha being in The Mandalorian here. Really good season so far that. But do you watch that?
I do, but I'm not caught up. I'm constantly behind and watching something that's already been on. I've seen all of season one and none of season two.
I love that it's a Western and Favreau just went for it with like, okay, this is just like, this is Paladin. This is Gunsmoke. And it's just got the Star Wars aesthetic. And in being its own thing, I think it's the best thing Star Wars has done since the original trilogy. I'm so impressed with it. For the Four Horsewomen, the Ascension, the Four Horsewomen, I think it's objectively very easy to say right now in 2020, it's Becky first, then Charlotte, then Bayley, then Sasha. I think that's the easy objective ranking. Then you can get into how exactly you want to argue one way or the other. And with Becky always coming out on top, then you can make different arguments for the other three. I do not see Sasha taking the second spot. I think the second spot is an argument between Bayley and Charlotte. But that depends on how you approach it. I know that JB also emailed about the Rascals, I'm not sure if we were going to address that separately, but yeah, I didn't know
that this email addressed the Rascals. JB said, word is the Rascals from Impact contracts are up and they have a standing offer from WWE that they're ready to accept. I'm not sure if you're familiar with their work. I'm not, but I assume that they will be assigned to NXT. Where do you think that they may slot in as a 3-man stable? A feud with Babyface UE or feud McAfee stable might be a good way to introduce them as big time players. As always, look forward to your thoughts, Tom.
Yeah, Trey Miguel, Desmond Xavier, and Zachary Wentz. There we go. I actually remembered all three of them live. I am somewhat familiar with them. I've seen a number of matches, particularly when I was covering Wrestle Circus for the Torch. I saw them quite a bit. And they are very good. I mean, you know, I'm not enough of an expert on them to really delve into why, but I was always impressed by them. So I think they would be an excellent addition to NXT. And honestly, even though this is something I've been extremely critical of, just speaking objectively again, if NXT wants that just frenetic, crazy work rate style to compete with AEW right now, Rascals are perfect. I guess here's a way I can put it. Rascals very much feel much more like an AEW type signing. So if that's what NXT is looking for to compete on Wednesday nights, then the Rascals are it. But I have been impressed by everything that I've seen from them. So that would be cool. Regarding the other tag team possibilities, So Rascals, obviously, yes, they do come to mind. And this is honestly in a somewhat shallow indies pool. And I'm not really saying that because it, you know, fewer indies have been running in 2020. I'm saying that because NXT signed up so many people all at once. And then AEW signed a bunch of people. So there aren't as many prime workers on the indies anymore. Not that there isn't a lot of talent out there, of course, but there aren't as many people that just seem to be, you know, begging to for that primetime contract. So it's a shallower pool to pick from, but I will say the Metro Boys, and they have been on NXT before. A lot of people probably remember them. Kelly, you probably remember them. They've been an enhancement team that's just come in. And they look like greasers, but they have a deeper characterization that they work on various indies. They're relatively prominent, and I think they're pretty darn awesome. So I would enjoy seeing that nod. I'll also throw out there the Jim Nasty Boys. They basically do the same thing that Ever-Rise does. They're not the exact same team, but they remind me very much of Ever-Rise's shtick. But the Jim Nasty Boys are interesting. I mean, I guess Argyle is asking more for top tier teams. And I think there's an argument to be made for the Metro Boys much more than the Jim Nasties. The Jim Nasties are an enhancement team. They are usually on the indies, not always. They would certainly be enhancement if they were in NXT. And then just looking right under the WWE umbrella, since NXT UK has a wealth of good tag teams and they can spare some, I'm going to say that, you know, who I really like is Lewis Howley and Sam Stoker. They are just like two handsome dudes that remind me of if Brood era Edge and Christian had been a little bit more Anne Rice. There's just something magnetic about them. I really like Howley and Stoker. And I say that I like them. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing Howley's last name correctly. It might be Holy, but either one works with the naming convention that they went with there, the obvious one. So I'll throw those guys out there.
They are a good pick. If you don't remember their names, I don't blame you, because I've seen 10, 15 of their matches. They are called Pretty Deadly, and I never remember their names because there's a lot of people on NXT UK that are similar in some way. But I think their act would be a boon to just about anywhere they went. Ever-Rise is kind of playing the role that I suppose that they would be, but I think that the ceiling is higher at this age for Pretty Deadly. As far as other tag teams, I don't have much for you because I watched all of NWA Power, and they had their tag team situation was kind of in a shambles. They had the Wild. Oh my gosh, I can't even think of their name now. But one of the two guys was Bram. And Bram is not walking through that door. He's not going back. So it doesn't matter how good they are. For those of you who don't know who Bram is, he at one point was in a relationship with Charlotte. Were they married? They were married. And he's had a couple of domestic incidents, and he's not going to WWE anytime soon. They had a couple other monster tag teams that were kind of okay, and they had the 3,000-year-old Rock and Roll Express occasionally winning the championship, and nobody there. And then in New Japan, there's just a handful of regular teams. if they really wanted, they could easily bring in Juice Robinson, who is the former CJ Parker in NXT, and his partner David Finlay, who, yes, is the son of the guy you know as Finlay, Fit Finlay. They are wonderful. They won the tag league in 2019. They could win it here in 2020. I don't think there's any plan for them at all to leave Japan and do what they're doing. But they are a tag team that could bolster any division in WWE if they felt the need. So there you go. Oh, and as far as the horsewomen, my order is the same as yours for all the same reasons, but you definitely could make some arguments with 3 and 4, 2 and 3. Yeah, I feel exactly the same as you. That is our show. My name is Kelly Wells. You can find me all over social media at Spooky Milk or Spooky Milk Games, Tom.
I am at Tom Staup. And just to answer Dr. Catani's question from earlier, even though he was already on the boobs list as an anti-masker, Drake Wirtz sure has found himself bumped up to the top of the list with even more that got dug up about him. If you follow me on Twitter, you know that I announced my own genuine shame in not going harder on Drake Wirtz in the past. I've kind of handled him with kid gloves, but I've seen his zealotry on social media, his relentless zealotry, and no matter how vile someone's rhetoric, if they believe that they are doing it in the name of their Lord, they cannot be talked to. And he, he's got his buddies. I mentioned the Forgotten Sons thing. He Jackson Riker and Bobby Fish are part of his Bible group. You can look at his social media, and there are other wrestlers like Brian Cage and Joey Ryan who comment on his posts. And, they believe they are righteous, but very recently, David Bixenspan dug up connections between Drake Wirtz and a white supremacist group. So there you go. Top of the boogs list to you.
Yeah. And with the Joey Ryan's, that's a podcast for somebody else to tackle, but to hell with it. I don't care that he's a great manager. He's not a great manager. He's a great referee. Okay. That's it. And as many words are bursting from me, we're going to go ahead and we're going to call it a day. And we will see you next week, folks, as NXT works towards War Games. All right. Cheers.